And tonight I'm excited. I've asked a good friend of mine to speak tonight, and he's become a friend, but been a mentor to me and a spiritual advisor and a my sponsor's best friend, and totally at the opposite end of the spectrum than my sponsor, and has some good things to say, and I'm excited about hearing his story tonight, my buddy Tony.
I'm Tony, a grateful recovering alcoholic.
Hello,
everyone. October 2nd, 1996 is my sobriety date. Thank you for asking me. Forgot to ask Jody, but I heard the introduction. I was wondering if it was singleness of purpose, but I guess that's not really pertinent, which is good. My story covers a number of things. One of the things when I came in, I'm originally from California. I was born and raised out there. And never really seemed to fit in. I'm not sure where that all came from. My mother got divorced when I was 8 and moved around. We were moving around quite a bit for whatever reason. And so I seemed to have to learn to fit in at each new school and so forth. And in doing so, I don't know if I really ever did fit in. I just tried to fit in. So it kept going around. And one of the things that, and from an early age, one of the things that helped me on fitting in was whatever the guys were doing, I did. 12, started smoking cigarettes at, I don't know, 13, started smoking pot. 14, drinking, you know, just whatever I could do with each other. And the one thing that I always, no matter what it was, when I could, I always felt if I could find something outside of me, I'd fit in. If whatever it was that they're looking at, I'd go for it. And as things went on, other substances kind of, I'll try that, I'll try this. And but one of the things in the doctor's opinion talks about, starting off, it says, suffered an alcoholic torture and said that the body of the alcoholic is quite abnormal as his mind. And then it goes on to say that we were maladjusted to life and that we were in full flight from reality. We were outright mental defectives. And when I first read that, after coming in here, didn't really like that, but it explained a lot, really explained a lot for what I was going through. My background was such, or at least my thought process was such, that I was always just trying to figure out whatever it looked like somebody else was doing to make them happy, I would try that. I didn't have any real clear idea what made me happy or would make me fulfilled or whatever. I mean, if it was when I was in my teens, I got caught. Well, I got caught doing everything, smoking, drinking. Anyway, one time I got caught smoking pot, and, you know, it was, I mean, I just didn't care. I mean, it was such, I walk into the house, it was blatant. My mother's crying, going, "You're high," and I go, "Yes, I am." And I just didn't care, you know. My stepfather at the time was a great man, or a really loving man, and he was smart enough to say, "Just go to bed. We'll talk about it in the morning," instead of getting all into it. And I just didn't care. And then the reason I bring that up is, all the things that came on, he called my parents friends. I mean, my friends' parents and all this. And so then I kind of got into, so I stopped doing those things. And part of it was got involved with CYO, which is Catholic Youth Organization, and went on retreats and kind of got a little more spiritual. And you know, I kind of got a little better. I was kind of all right for a while. But, and the doctor's been in, it also talks about that it's a physical allergy coupled by a mental obsession. And when things were going all right in those teen years, that allowed me to get through high school, get into college, kind of move along. Once I moved out of there, well, one of the things that kind of started to back up was my neighbor was manager of a liquor store. And there, kind of a, I mean, it was in San Francisco Bay Area, but it was kind of a small suburban town. And for whatever reason, the liquor store closed at 9 o'clock, which doesn't make a lot of sense, but that's when it did. And no one wanted to close. So he would always ask me if I wanted to close. And I'm like, yeah, no problem. I mean, I'm 18, drinking age is 21, and I can take whatever I want out the back of the store because I'm the only one closing. I mean, that was just, so that physical allergy started again. Now I'm ready to walk out. I was at least smart enough to realize pay for it. And so all my friends, we'd collect money. I'd pay for whatever we bought and just take it out the back of the door. So, spirituality, dropped down, started doing that, then went away to college. And then some other substances started coming involved with that. And, you know, I mean, it was just a matter of trying to fit in. Now I'm, at this time I graduate to, or transfer into a four-year university after going 2 years with a junior college, so didn't quite feel like I fit in. I didn't start off with all of them in the dorms. Everything else, I just, but this was the same pattern. I was comfortable with that pattern. I knew what to do. Figure out how to party, find out who to party with, and run with that. Part of my consequences were such, I went up there to study architecture. I worked hard at that. It's a five-year degree, and my fourth year, I flunked out of it. I mean, it demands a lot of time, and partying requires a lot of time. And the bottom line was I went to partying instead of went to doing what I needed to do. Fortunately enough, I was able to graduate. The interesting thing was is that, reflecting back on it, is probably a couple years after that, maybe 25, 26, maybe a little more than that, I noticed a lot of my friends that I partied with in college, they didn't party as much anymore. I just kind of kept on with that pace. I just thought that was the pace. And so much to the point at 25, 26, I knew I was an alcoholic. I said it. I knew it outright. There was alcoholism in the family. It was such that I just kind of, we had functioning alcoholics, some that did very well and some that didn't. And my experience in the family was just, well, for that matter, my grandmother was in AA. She was running the central service office. So kind of had both sides of it. Had AA and in functioning alcoholics. And I just figured, all right, I don't want to not drink. I mean, there's, my view was it's going to be boring. All my fun has been partying. When I'm not partying, I got that mental obsession going of when am I going to do it again. So my view, whenever I wasn't doing it, I kept thinking about when am I going to do it again. And that was just a miserable, miserable time. So my view was that if I'm not drinking, it's not going to work. Which is, again, in the doctor's opinion, he talks about that we drank essentially because we liked the effects produced by alcohol. I did not like the way I felt when I didn't have anything in me. Bottom line. and I didn't like, I was maladjusted to life. I didn't know how to deal with life, but I just knew how to drink. Later on, there's a solution. It says, the fact is that most alcoholics, for some reason yet obscure, have lost the power of the choice of drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force of memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. I mean, when I'm talking about 25, 26, I knew I'd lost that power of choice. Back then, I'm drinking every day. And my view of partying on Friday, Saturday nights is now we're either smoking dope, or back then was a lot of coke. Doing a lot of coke, but primarily on the weekends and in the end of the week. But I'm still drinking all the way through this. I'm drinking 7 days a week. And my view is, okay, I'm just going to have to manage that. And I have, at the time, what I thought were successful men managing their alcoholism. So I didn't think that was an unattainable goal. And it wasn't until things were not going my way. I mean, I got out of college and no one was pounding on my door. My job opportunities were not to my liking. I was critical of them all. They were all beneath me. They were, all my bosses were stupid. And the work I was doing was stupid. And I was bored. So every night, I'm getting drunk. That's my fun time. Work is my bored time. And I'm just sessing through there to wait till I get to the end of the day. And one thing to also back up, when I was mentioning in college, when I was 21, my real father, who I loved and had moved away, but still lived, I had seen him that spring break, and found out that he had cancer. I knew he had cancer, and I was told then that he was going to die. By my stepmother, I was the only one she told, and saying she was going to lose it when he did it, so I had to be tough to come back. I remember getting that call when I was in college, not wanting to, and I actually, it was funny, I mean, I was in a fraternity at the time, and I told them that, you know, I don't want the call. I knew what the call was, and anyways, they forced me to take the call. And as all I knew was to go and get drunk. Actually, I went up to my room and I cried, I would say, for somewhere between 30 and 60 seconds. And just said, okay, brush it off and let's go. And went and got drunk. And the reason I bring that up is because that kind of escalated my party. That just kind of put me on another plateau again. When I was around 28, I guess 27, 28, 27, well, anyway, 26. I'm looking at my sister over here. That's why my stepfather died. And that also did the same thing, kind of escalated a little more. And I noticed I was doing a lot more drugs and a lot of drinking. Although I was always doing a lot of drinking. That was just, to me, drinking was a common, everyday occurrence for me. At that time, she's given me permission before, but my sister went into treatment for cocaine, and she didn't drink, but gathering with her. My father's death kind of escalated it with her or not. That would be her. I don't really want to speak for her on that. But anyway, so she went into treatment. My view of it was she had a problem. I wasn't doing it every day, so it might not be quite a problem for me. And I had another sister who was here in Atlanta, and I was working for my father at the time, and kind of had to finish out the business for the estate. And she said, well, why don't you come to Atlanta? My view was, that's a good way to get away from the dealers. That was my answer. My other sister was in treatment. A good way to stop doing coke was leave town. And I did. I did. That's how I got to Atlanta, 1988. And I did not find any dealers. And I was still irritable, but I was feeling a little better. All right, I'm not doing this, but I'm still drinking every day. And I'm still looking for, you know, kind of looking back at my life. It's been a waste. I've wasted all this money on drugs. I don't have anything. And I'm looking at my friends and other people, seeing them have things, and they're kind of going along with it. At the time, I was just saying San Francisco is way too expensive. I could never afford any of those things, which was also another reason why I logically said, I'll go to Atlanta. It's cheaper than San Francisco. And I don't find any dealers. When I got here, within the first month I'm here, I meet a woman, start dating her, who eventually becomes my wife. She doesn't do drugs. She did a little bit of it, but didn't like doing them. My view was, that's Tony, that's a healthy relationship. That might help me. She doesn't do drugs, and I don't need to do drugs. And that just might work. But drinking's okay. Well, I thought drinking was okay, because every time we went out, we drank. But that was part of my doing, then I think hers. And even though I knew I was an alcoholic, that still did not bother me. I just thought it was a way that... kind of had it under control. And after dating her for a while, kind of figured that I'm 29, it's probably about 28, going on 30. I really haven't done any drugs with her. She's probably a good person to marry. And she'll keep me clean, and I'll start to get those things. And I went on that for a while, and got miserable with a couple of jobs, so changed to another job, and went through a couple of paths. Kind of took her through, you know, she's dating a guy who's asked her to marry her, he's got a stable job, and I'm sitting there thinking that I'm unappreciated. My boss is stupid, doesn't know what's going on, I could run the business better. And couple of years in the marriage, I say, you know what, I want to go and do this commission only job, because that way I know I'll show my real worth and I'll be rewarded for my efforts. So she's now got to foot the bill and carry me through this commission time. There were times that I did very well at it, actually, but it's, I don't know if anybody's been in that business, but it's a somewhat of a feast or famine. The feast goes up, and I drink more. Decided it's time to party a little heavier and keep going on it. But now that I've got another person that I'm living with, they're seeing all my activities. And she's not liking it. And kind of figure out how to manage her that way. And my view of managing it was, is she was from Mississippi, and near New Orleans, loved Mardi Gras, used to talk all about that. So my view is, I'll give up drinking for Lent. And she understood what Lent was about, so that would be a way I could give up drinking. It had nothing to do with any religious reasons, other than I found out it managed my drinking and my marriage well. You know, with the nice thing about that for me is during the holidays, you can't really tell me not to drink because everybody's having parties. It's a good time. You know, it's a natural time to party. Now, it is okay to say that right after the holidays, now it's time to calm down and to slow down the drinking. But that's when I then say, well, I'm giving it up for Lent, so get off my back. This is a good time. Give me another couple of months. And I go through, and with that mental obsession, I torturously go through Lent. Then I start right back where I was. Make sure Good Friday is my alcohol run day. Make sure I got it for Easter, and I run. And now that also buys me another 2 or 3 months of heavy drinking every day. Because then if you're getting on my back, I just gave it up for Lent. And in my mind, I'm thinking I can stop at any time. I'm just choosing I don't want to. But I had lost that power of choice, and I really knew that. And I went through this cycle for 2 years of marriage, but I know from my 2nd year on, I know that was the case. So for about 5 years. And I tried to, and one of the times with stopping was I had my godfather who was my uncle, who I'd seen that Christmas of 95, was raging alcoholic, had lost everything. By the time, you know, I've been hearing it from my mother, what was going on with him, you know. At the end, I'm not sure if he was working, but at some point he had to drive 100 miles one way because he'd burned every bridge in his industry before then. And I'd seen him that Christmas, and I hadn't seen him for about 5 years, and I barely recognized him. He looked horrible. The following June of 96, he was found dead. He was dead for 2 days before anybody found him in some motel room. And I remembered what he looked like at my age. At how old was it? 36. And he died in his early to mid-50s. And I was feeling my inner battle for years of my alcoholism. It was, I was trying to keep my wife and everybody else off my back with Lent, but I was really battling it back and forth. Inside, I knew it had a grip on me, and I knew I was losing the battle. My life was getting worse and worse and worse. The job was getting worse. My performance was getting worse. I wasn't doing well at all. And he scared me. That really scared me. I really saw that was my path, what my uncle went through. I could really see, clear as day, for some reason, I had a moment of clarity, that's what's going to happen. And so I quit. And this time I quit for me. This was truly the first time I'd quit for me. Lent was always a quit. I always quit because I knew I could drink. I knew I could drink again. I knew I couldn't stay stopped, and I knew I had Easter where I could look forward to. When I quit this time, and I quit for me, and I quit for good, it lasted for a few weeks, and a couple, three weeks. And then we had a party for my wife, and it was like, well, you know, you've been good for a month, you can have a couple. And I'll start the next day right back up. Well, the party was at my house, and maybe I should back up 1 second, too. When I was talking about this misery that I was battling with, this, that my life was getting worse and worse, I was starting to feel it internally. Not starting to. I had been feeling it internally. Now I have a wife, got a house, we have a pool, we have two cars. I'm having everything that from early on, I'm chasing what everybody says is supposed to make you happy. And it's not making me happy. I'm just feeling worse and worse. And so we have this party by our pool and all this, and I do pretty good. I only have four, and I was thinking it was pretty good, but I bought the alcohol. So I had a ton left over on Sunday. I just had it. I mean, I just buy it. In doing so, no one was around on Sunday. I was doing some stuff around the house, and I don't know, out of nowhere, I start drinking again. Just how it talks about in the Bible. I just start drinking. And I do the same thing like I did before. I drank until I almost pass out. I knew how to get all the way up until I got to bed, and I passed out in bed. In doing so, you know, I mean, those stories are various ones. I mean, I remember the alcohol I drank, the volumes that I drank at that time, you know, I mean, I didn't help the situation with the marriage as well, in that, you know, I'd wake up the morning and bitch at my wife because she bought this nice down comforter and my side of the bed is full of bed sweats. And I'm blaming everything on her. It's on that, you know, it's the stuff that you're built, you know, you made this bed too warm. And that happened continuously. And she's trying to do whatever she's trying to do to make it work. And, you know, anything to look that it has anything to do with me, what was going on. It's put her through quite a bit. I had always talked, my sister got sober, like I said. At this time, she's probably sober about 7-8 years. And all through this, every time I was giving up for Lent and everything, you know, she would always ask me, we're always close, how are you doing? How's it going? And I was always, for some reason, I was always honest with her about where I stood, part of my struggles with it. And her answer was always, if you ever want to go to a meeting, let me know. And I'll take it. That was the only answer to it. So I decided to go to a meeting. And even though my grandmother had been in the program, she ended up dying with 45 years sobriety. And my sister had been in the program for 8 years. I had no idea what it was other than they don't drink ever again. You go to AA, you're not going to drink again. And that was boring to me. That's a boring life. My view was, but I was at a point with that, I was seeing my life was getting worse and worse and worse to where I decided, well, you know what? Boring's at least not worse. I'll go at least boring. And so she invited me to go up to this meeting. On Wednesday night, only condition is don't drink that day, which I didn't. Go in, at that meeting on Wednesday night, they end up splitting up. I thought I was going to the meeting with my sister, but they split up between men's and women's. And there was a guy there that she introduced me to that went into this meeting. Didn't know much about it. He guided me all the way through with his elbow, you know. Newcomers, boom, that's you, all right, you know. Anybody else, you know, white chip, boom, that's you, go off. Okay, all right, you know. I really didn't know, you know. They said anybody needed a sponsor, boom, that's you. You go up afterwards. And this is how God works. I mean, that's what I did. And I have no idea what happened in that meeting other than the elbows and going up to the desk. And at the desk, this guy there, there's three of us that come up, and he goes, You. He picks three guys out of the room and says, you. So I meet this man, and we go, and sit out for a while. And he gives me this book, this big book. Talks a little bit about his experience. And says, you know, primarily, have I had enough alcohol? What's my, am I powerless? And have it, do I understand? Didn't ask me to understand the step, but just am I powerless? And I said, yeah. He said, so alcohol is more powerful than me. I said, yes, alcohol is more powerful than me. I can't control it. And he says, then you're screwed. Because if you can't control it, you need to find something that's more powerful than it. And he said, I suggest you pray to that. That just that will keep you, keep control over your alcohol. And he said, I don't care what you call it. I call it God. You don't even have to believe it exists. I know it exists. You don't have to believe. Because you know what? You're screwed either way. And I was. I mean, I understood that. That part I understood. And I followed some suggestions. And that was, and it was, get on your knees in the morning and ask that, ask God, which it wasn't a matter of even defining it. I mean, it was just to keep you sober today. And I did. And I meant that desperately. Because I knew that I did not, it had me. And so again, and then he had me, got me this big book. We started going through the book. And in reading this book, you know, I never knew how I felt. I couldn't have verbalized what was going on with me until I was reading it. And I'm going, this is me. This is my confusion that I'm going through. I knew how it felt, but I couldn't identify it and explain it. You know? And so we went through this book. And now, let me also be upfront about it. It was not all rosy from that point on. I kind of had a pink cloud. Things were going good. My first 3 months, might have been my first month, I turn around and go, I quit my job and God's going to lead me to where I'm going. My wife is really kind of freaked now. You know, she's going, what in the world? First of all, you're drinking, and I can't trust that. Now you're just throwing everything on out. My sponsor's freaking, too. He's kind of going, hey, man, you know, that's, maybe you don't want to do that. I go to this other job, and fortunately, I'm able to get my old job back, and he's like, that's pretty good. All right. So that it kind of stabilized, and then this was, by the way, this was in the July and August, and December 1st, I go get tickets to go to a football game, Monday Night Falcons game, from work, and ask my brother-in-law to go, and we're driving down to the game, and he's got a joint and says, want to smoke some pot? And I'm like, you know, that was never a problem for me. I think I will. And horrible. Man, I'm high as a kite. I haven't been high in, you know, 3 months or drunk. Horrible buzz, sitting here at the dome and watching beers pass by me, and I'm obsessed. I'm not going to drink. I'm just not going to drink. And I didn't drink. Call my sponsor. By the way, I ought to tell you this. And I said, and I really don't think that's a reason to go back, pick back up. I mean, it's going to AA, dealing with alcohol. And I've never really had a problem with pot. And his comment back to me is, well, then you're not going to have a problem giving it up. That was a tough one. I really did not have a comeback. And I was, oh man, I was embarrassed and moaning to go in and pick up a white chip, but I started back over, so that's where, and I do honor that date. That's the date I go by. You know, we go through, you know, I'm motivated, go on through a period of time with this sobriety that I got to a point, that pink cloud kind of came back, whatever was going along. The fellowship was carrying me for a good while. And I'm not getting what I'm seeing other people get in this program. And I'm moaning to my sponsor of, you know, what? How come I'm not getting all this self-esteem? Everybody talks about this self-esteem. What's going on here? It's not working for me, you know. And he's like, do esteemable acts. And I couldn't figure that out. I mean, there's a lot of things. I mean, the bottom line for me, when it talks about it early on in the, that we're maladjusted to life, I didn't know how to live life. I couldn't figure out what are things. I mean, I still, and I said to him, I don't know what that is. And he'd say, do the next right thing. And I'd say, I don't know what that is. You know, it talks about we have a, and also talks about in the doctor's opinion that we have difficulty discerning the true from the false. You know, that's not, the way I understand it, it's not that everything I think is true is false and everything false is true. Some of it's true, some of it's false, some of, I just can't discern which one is which. So I really had a hard time. I had to learn how to live. It was like, what's, and there were times like, well, what's the next right thing? Have you brushed your teeth today? Oh, okay. I'll go do that. I mean, it had to be real simple. I had to go and start doing this. Going to bed early. That's the right thing to do. Okay. And being married, and my wife used to, and I developed this problem with this drinking with her. So there's this, I wouldn't say I developed any great communication skills with her. And so, on top of that, I go and get sober, and I'm really changing this relationship. I mean, it's me changing the relationship. She's the constant one, or more or less, and I'm the one bouncing all over the board. And I'm getting angry. I've got a lot of anger, a lot of things going on, and with that, and I get to a point about 9 months where I say to my sponsor that, you know, I'm in so much pain and anger and everything else with this that I'm in more pain than when I was drinking. Even though I was miserable and it was getting worse, I'm in more pain than when I was drinking. He goes, okay. We were at breakfast over at OK Cafe. I says, all right. He goes, you going to meetings? Oh, yeah. I'm in 5-6 a week. Good, good. They read how it works every meeting. Oh, yeah. He goes, why don't you do how it works? Well, so I had to start the steps. And that's where it started to happen. You know, but for me, and I'm not saying this is just my story, pain was my motivator. I had to get in some pain in sobriety to push me that way. You know, and I tell guys that I work with, pain is still my motivator today. You know, the big difference for me today than before is when I was drinking, I could take a lot of pain. Pain and misery is what I knew. Now that I'm sober, I'm a wimp to pain. I just don't have the tolerance I used to anymore. Doesn't mean I don't hold on to it. It doesn't mean I won't go for it for a little while. But it doesn't last as long. And I've been shown enough in this program that I can change. And things can change if I do some things. So I now have a way how to deal with my have some more direction, and some men that I talk to that know me. You know, the honesty of in this program with the number of men that having a little bit of time now that I've walked this path with for a good number of years, it helps for them to see me as I am. They can see it, and when I'm in pain, I talk about it earlier. Still resistant to do the work sometimes, you know, but the solutions I've found has been in this program and with the steps. I mean, you know, I did not understand until, well, let me back. Where is it? When I first got in here, and talks about we're selfish and self-centered. Says that's the root of our troubles. And I used to say, you know, my view of life was to be a good husband, and you know, even when it before getting married, when I was dating a woman, dating as well, I remember saying to this one girlfriend, and she would be bitching about what I was doing. My view is, well, you know, if I do and take responsibility for my happiness, then I can come into the relationship whole. Therefore, I'm bringing all of me. But if I give up these things, then I'm only bringing 50% of me, and then the relationship wouldn't be whole. So I need to party. That makes me whole. And I understood this selfishness and self-centeredness, because that's what I did all the time. I put it in my logic of how to have a relationship. How to have a relationship was, I'm going to do what I want to do, and you either stick around or you don't. You want to stick around with those terms? I'm okay. Now, at the same point in that, I also got to say I'm full of fear. So I'm not wanting her to go. So I'll also let whatever happen as long as I can drink every night. So I'm not that demanding other than I want to get drunk. And I don't know, I seem to find enough women that it worked. For whatever reason, it seemed to work that way. But when it talks about selfishness and self-centeredness, I had an understanding of that, and I had an understanding of some consequences of it with some of these relationships. It's the only way I kind of saw it before. But on 62, when it talks about we're selfish and self-centered, and that we think is the root of our troubles, I don't really understand what that means. I mean, as a man, selfishness and self-centered is a little ambiguous. I mean, I don't have to take responsibility for myself, do what I'm supposed to do, take care, you know. I'm not clear with that, of how that, I mean, I understand what the terms mean by the dictionary and so forth and psychologically. But right after that sentence, the next sentence says, it's driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. That gets a little more definition of what it is. And that's what I am. I have self-delusion, 100 forms of it. It's subtle. I don't know what I just look at things, and my perspective about me is just off. It's just a little delusion. I don't know where it's coming from other than it's coming from either a fear, a self-seeking, or a self-pity. I know, and those are in 100 forms, so they're real subtle, and I didn't understand. That I do understand, and that is still my problem today. You know, I take this paragraph when he's talking about this, not that this is before or after. This is who I am. And that's one of the real benefits of this program, is I can talk to my sponsor, talk to Jody, to others, to Dean or whoever, friends of mine, and they're not delusional about me. They can see me. I'm just delusional about me. Just like I can see them clearer than sometimes they can see themselves. And that's just the beauty of this program, that when we got some honesty and we got some relationships, we get to see that. Because my fears, which I did not realize, and I would have told you I didn't have until I got to that fourth step. And we're talking about those fears, the self-seeking and the self-pity. I really didn't understand what I was doing. When I saw that, you know, that was a big revelation to me. So I'm giving up drinking. I'm now doing a little work. I'm starting to see me. And I'm praying to this it, to this God. And he's keeping me sober for a while. And it's working pretty good. My experience has been with 6 and 7, followed the path, the book. I do 8, get my list together. For me, step 9, not only the promises came together, but things happened with my amends and some people coming that, well, I'll give you an example of one. I'm at this time at my 9th step. And I'm married by that time 6 years, 7 years, I don't know. And I dated my wife a couple years before. Well, the woman that I had met was dating just before that. So give or take, about 8 years later, from when I last saw her, she calls me in the middle of the 9th step. And I owed her money and a lot of amends. Not only does she call me, she's in Germany, calls information, and my phone number had a number of 7, had a lot of 7s in it, and just said, "That's him," and calls me. And I get to make that amends. And I'm literally gone. I pick up the phone, and I'm going, I know exactly why this call is here. And that's one of those moments, and there were some others, that I knew God existed, and God cared about me, what I was doing, and exactly where I was. He didn't do this when I was drinking 4 years ago, beforehand, 4 years before that or whatever. He does it exactly when I'm at a time that I understand what I need to say. Hey, I owe you all this money. Because before, I always put it aside. Because, well, I can't really take it from my wife to give it to her. You know, that's not really she wouldn't really go for that. You know, I've already put my wife through enough. That my sponsor was, no, you just follow it along and see. Well, it happens to be, she's married. And she's saying, if I give her the money, that'll confuse her marriage, and that means she's got to say she called me, which is a whole different subject, but that's and I'm like, okay. Now, I don't mean that God forgives is not going to mean that you don't have to make financial amends. I told her that the money is hers, and if she ever needs it, she's entitled to it, and she is. But more my point of it is in this process, I start with a little bit of faith of just how, in minimal faith of just for God to take care of my alcoholism, and just because I knew I was screwed. To at a certain point down the path, I know God knows I exist and cares about what I'm doing and will help me. And that's a great way to live. And that's the way that, in my experience, that's what this program gives you. And some great fellowship as well. So I guess it's 9 o'clock. I should stop. Thanks for inviting me, and thanks for having me.
Thanks, Tony. That was awesome. I could relate to a lot of that.